Can Europe have a defence strategy of its own? There have been more calls for the need for a united military power. But can the Europeans survive without NATO and the United States? This is Inside Story. Hello, welcome to the programme. I'm Hazem Seeker. The idea of a common defence has long been debated among European leaders. The bloc has historically relied on the NATO alliance and the United States for military action. But after the Taliban took over Afghanistan this year and the mass evacuations that followed, questions arose about the European Union's ability to drive its own defence policy. On Monday, the Hungarian Prime Minister was the latest leader to call for a common defence force in Europe. He was holding talks with the French president during a summit of East European leaders.
First, we both love our countries. Second, we both work for strengthening Europe. And finally, we will, I think, agree on the fact that Europe needs strategic autonomy. There are three notions we see fitting under strategic autonomy. I will share this with the president. We believe there is no autonomy without a European defense industry. We believe there is no autonomy without our own nuclear energy capabilities. And there is no autonomy without self-sufficiency in agriculture.
EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen had also highlighted the need for the bloc to step up its military capabilities in order to be able to confront security threats and global crises.
Our European Union is a unique security provider. There will be missions where NATO or the United Nations will not be present, but where Europe should be. You can have the most advanced forces in the world, but if you're never prepared to use them, of what use are they? What has held us back until now is not just a shortfall of capacity, it is the lack of political will.
Well, let's take a closer look at how much EU governments spend on defence. A recent European Defence Agency report showed the bloc spent a record $225 billion last year, a 5% increase on 2019. But there was a fall in joint investment. The continent spent just 11% of their total equipment purchases in cooperation with other EU governments. Despite the lack of cooperation, the bloc still plans a joint military force of up to 5,000 troops by 2025 to deploy during emergencies. Well, let's bring in our guest now to talk more about this. In Washington, D.C., we have Thorsten Benner. He is a co-founder and director of the Global Public Policy Institute in Berlin. In Brussels, Teresa Fallon, a director of the Center for Russia-Europe-Asia Studies. And joining us from Oslo, Glenn Diesen, professor of international relations at the University of Southeastern Norway. Good to have you all with us. Thorsten Benner, if I could start this by asking, does a European defense force make sense strategically?
Yes, thanks for having me, Hassan. Of course, it makes strategic sense in the medium term. The question is how to make it a reality and what realistic next steps are. There's a lot of political talk about European strategic autonomy, about European strategic sovereignty. Even Hungarian Prime Minister Orbán kind of pretended he's a great advocate of this and fully in line with President Macron, that he's all in favor of strengthening Europe, whereas on the rule of law and other issues, Prime Minister Orbán undermines Europe. Ursula von der Leyen said it's not just a question of capabilities or capacity, but of political will. That's true. We need the political will to really up our game. Europe does spend quite a bit on defense, but it needs to kind of pool and share and get out of this national parochialism of national defense industries and really work to a Europe toward a Europe-wide defense industry, strengthening its innovation base and really work toward that. And I think then this direction could become a reality. But the important thing is not to talk just about distant, unrealistic goals for the time for the time being, but to really talk about concrete steps to invest in concrete capabilities as Europe.
Theresa Fallon, what do you see as the motivation for a Europe Defence Force?
Well, we see with the Macron, he will be having the EU rotating council presidency. In addition to that, he's running for office in France. So he's really pushing the strategic autonomy narrative. This is something that he has been long known to profess. He mentioned about 2 years ago that NATO was brain dead. France has often been seen as a real pushing the strategic autonomy narrative. But there are two ways to look at this. One could be that Europe that is stronger, that does more burden sharing, would be actually more useful to NATO. So for the last 30 years, there's been kind of a night since 1989, this idea that there's a kind of a peace dividend. So there, as you mentioned earlier, there's been so much money spent, but has it really been used wisely? And what about capacities? There's big issues in gaps in logistics and even basic communications among the EU member states, let alone inside NATO. So I think that strengthening Europe and having a strengthened pillar within NATO would actually be hugely beneficial, especially since we're not only facing Russia anymore, we're facing Russia, China, Iran, South Korea. So I think that the Europeans need to be far more active and use their funding more carefully. We've talked about battle groups. Thorsten mentioned those. And, you know, they have never been used. So there's a lack of a political will. And there's the sense that many times that Europeans like to arbitrage tensions between the U.S. and China, for example, to their benefit. So we need to have everyone on the same page. And I think that with the recent democracy summit that Biden held, I think he's trying to get everyone involved. And I should note that Orban was not invited to this. And it's interesting that Macron reached out to him at the recent Visegrad summit held there. So let's see how things turn out.
Glenn Deason, we mentioned in the setup there about how the rapid collapse of the government in Kabul and the takeover of the Taliban in August raised questions about the European Union's ability to drive its own defense policy. Do you think that's the only thing that's driving this, though?
No, I think, I think there's a lot of both international changes as well as internal. So obviously, if Macron, as Theresa Fallon pointed out on many occasions that the U.S. is in relative decline, also becoming less reliable. So this is something that Merkel also echoed, saying that, you know, Europe has to be able to take care of itself and not rely too much on the U.S. However, the focus they've in the areas they want to develop, though, suggests in terms of defense, nuclear and energy, agriculture, it suggests that, the defense is obviously an initiative to become less reliant on NATO, which means to have more independence from the United States. The focus on the nuclear energy is obviously to have less reliance on Russia. And this fits within what the EU has defined as strategic autonomy, which is that the EU should have more influence but be less dependent on others. Now, I would also add that this also has an implication for the internal dynamics of the EU, because it's obvious that this is a French proposal. That is, that the EU is led with Germany and France at the center, although France is obviously the weaker part, as Germany is the economic center. However, an EU that bases strategic autonomy and more on common defense and nuclear energy obviously shifts the power more towards France, putting it more in the center of the EU as opposed to only Germany. So I think it has this is an initiative, to reposition the EU's place in the world, but also reorganize the power structures within the EU itself.
Thorsten Bennett, if I could come back to you on this. We heard Ursula von der Leyen, the EU Commission President, saying that there needs to be more of a political will to do this. And I know you touched on this in your earlier answer, but where does that political will come from? Does it come from France and Germany, or does it come from elsewhere in the European Union? What form does that political will take?
I think it needs to... The large member states need to lead by example. We talked about a more unified, stronger European defense industry. If the smaller countries get the impression that this only means that their companies will be swallowed by German or French companies, that's not a very sustainable model. So the German and Germany and France need to lead by example, make offers to also smaller countries, also in terms of building capabilities in terms of that are complementary. Not every country needs to have every capability, and the larger countries need to, first of all, invest in their own military capabilities, and then make offers to the smaller countries on where to cooperate. So I think the real burden is on the larger, more economically and politically stronger member states to really lead by example, and so that smaller countries don't have the impression that, for example, President Macron's talk about European sovereignty is mostly about France and less so about Europe.
Theresa Fallon, we heard the Hungarian President Viktor Orbán talk about what he said was strategic autonomy when he was referring to this European Defence Force. But what exactly does that mean? And do Europe and the United States have different definitions of that?
You hit it on the head. Exactly. There are different definitions. I attended a conference once here in Brussels. People were flown in from all over Europe to attend a special think tank conference on strategic autonomy. And after one full day, we were waiting for Federica Mogherini to show up. She was late, so I turned to my left and I asked the German next to me, do you know what strategic autonomy means now? And they said, nope. And I turned to the right and I asked the French person sitting next to me, and he said, no. So the idea of strategic autonomy is very ambiguous, I would say. The French have a view of it, as we've been discussing, but I would say other member states, especially those in the Baltics, are very concerned about this strategic autonomy narrative. I almost saw people coming to blows at this conference about strategic autonomy, because those who are closest to Russia feel actually the most worrisome about these threats, and fear that maybe France would not really come to their to help them in case there was any sort of invasion. So I think that it's not lost on the European audience that Macron, who is going to be, as of January 1st, having the EU Council rotating presidency, he's trying to get the message across to the Central and Eastern Europeans. They had a Visegrad event take place there, that he's their man. And because there is a great deal of skepticism from those members. So with the EU, you have 27 EU member states. Some of them are neutral, but those in Central and Eastern Europe are very dubious about France having this type of separate identity outside of NATO. They're very pro-NATO. So I think that he was trying to build a bridge towards them. And I think that this is a huge problem because you have different French leaders, and NATO's been around for over 70 years. So I think that there are habits of cooperation. Yes, it needs to be fine-tuned. It needs to be improved. But there's huge other areas that it would be difficult for the Europeans to replace, for example, cyber, as well as space. All of these issues, I mean, NATO has these capacities. So I think a more useful Europe would be better overall. But we also see, you know, it's not like China's far away, as many Europeans tend to think. We're seeing China penetrating Europe far more through daily cyber attacks, also through the Arctic. We have Russia, obviously, rattling sabers outside of the Ukrainian border. So I think that Europe has a lot to think about. Plus, in addition to that, we have issues and tensions in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and the whole Balkans is in a difficult situation. So I think Europe really has to get very serious about this. And of course, to pick up on a previous point, Macron's going to push the NATO, the nuclear aspect, because this is also a problem in the Franco-German engine, because the Green Party, which is now part of the coalition government, is not so keen on nuclear, and they will not. It is unlikely that they are going to see it as a sustainable resource, which Macron wants to have it identified as. So for this green strategy of the EU, it's unclear at this moment if nuclear will be considered a green type of fuel. So I think that there are problems already. The new coalition government in Germany has only been in power a week, but we see already cracks in the relationship between France and Germany.
Glenn Deason, what would a European defense force look like to you?
Well, it would probably be somewhat weak. You know, they said that the French are a leader with no one who wants to follow them. And I think that's quite a good description. And I also agree that a lot of the Eastern European countries would be hesitant to pursue this strategic autonomy simply because it means getting more independence from the United States, which means a weakened NATO. And a lot of them have put bet most of the security on their NATO membership. But again, this is part of the problem in Europe. It's becoming very divided in terms of the interest. So I think for many, they view that NATO is part of the problem. I mean, every single pan-European security agreement we've had, from the Helsinki Accords in 1995 to the Charter of Paris in 1990 to the establishment of the OSCE, had this concept of indivisible security at its center. Now, NATO expansionism has effectively violated all these principles of indivisible security, which has been the foundation of pan-European security. And as a result, we're having now the collapse of a pan-European security architecture, which is why we're having these conflicts with Russia. Now, the benefit of having more of a EU army would be it is less threatening to Russia, given that NATO is deemed to be the main threat to Russia. And with a reduced role for NATO, reduce some of the tensions in Europe. But that being said, an EU army on its own would be somewhat... It wouldn't be very effective, given that it's the United States that's carrying most of the brunt, or is the main member of NATO. So it would be a very different European security architecture. So my opinion, it would be less need for a military, given that the relations with Russia would be much better. But obviously, it would also be a much weaker and less efficient military as well.
Let's talk a little bit more about this relationship with NATO, Torsten Benner. Is there a risk that a European Defence Force might undermine NATO? Or, what sort of role would it play that's different to that organisation? Because, of course, there are a lot of countries. There is a lot of overlap there, isn't there, in terms of member countries that are already part of NATO. So how would that work?
Exactly. There is no contradiction between stronger European capabilities and a strong NATO, as long as the US wants that. I think it's very easy to imagine Europe building up more capabilities and making them useful within NATO by carrying more of its own weight in terms of deterring Russian aggression and not just relying on the U.S. For this. So as long as NATO is viable and as long as the U.S. is able and willing to underwrite European security, more capabilities will also make, on the European part, will make NATO stronger. So that's not at all a contradiction. And at the same time, it's a hedge against a possible future in which the U.S. no longer underwrites European security. And a very clear future in which the U.S. is much more focused on the Indo-Pacific theater, so that Europe needs to take care of relations in its neighborhood, especially also with Russia by itself. And Glenn has a very funny reading of history and relations with Russia, where Europe and the U.S. are the only culprits, where a shiny, happy future with the Kremlin would be in the cards if we only disarmed and dissolved NATO. I think history tells a very different story. Of course, we need to take the Kremlin's own threat perceptions seriously, but this very funny, strange, and peculiar reading of history that you offered, Glenn, doesn't pass muster.
All right, let's get Glenn's response to that.
Yes, no, I didn't say that NATO has to be disbanded. I think that NATO was quite effective when it did very little. That is, throughout the Cold War, it was effectively a power promoting the status quo. That is, it was a defensive alliance seeking to deter the Soviet Union. After the Cold War, NATO has become a revisionist power. That is, it's now expanding its invading other countries without UN mandates. So under this new NATO, the revisionist NATO, I think it's very much destabilizing, and it's the main source of tensions and conflict in Europe. And these divisions in Europe, dividing lines, is also making Europe as a continent less and less relevant. Now, if NATO would go back to its original mission to be a status quo power and end its military interventionism and end its expansionism, it could again be a source of stability in Europe. However, this is kind of what they're trying to negotiate now between Moscow and Washington. But that's very different from saying that NATO has to be dismantled.
Teresa Fallon,
if NATO were the only problem, why did President Putin choose to invade Crimea after Ukraine signed a cooperation deal with the European Union? It was not NATO that was the problem in that case. It was a deal with the European Union.
Well, it's to a large extent because of the salami tactics. It can see what's coming down the road. I mean, the NATO started with expanding to a couple of countries. Now it just keeps expanding. And obviously the U.S. has stated its intention of dragging Ukraine into NATO, even when only a small minority wanted to be a part of NATO. And furthermore, they didn't simply sign an agreement with the EU. There was a coup backed by both the United States and the EU. And because of this, the Russians reacted as a status quo power would be by holding on to its naval base in Crimea. So again, if NATO had not, the West had not backed a coup in Ukraine, and NATO hadn't threatened to expand into Ukraine, Russia would never have taken back Crimea. Right. So,
I want to give what's probably going to be the last word on this to Teresa Fallon. Go ahead.
Well, I think it's always important to try to understand how the Russians see the world. It's very different from most other people. I think that status quo, I mean, seizing Crimea, and over 14,000 people have died in the Donbass. So the idea that NATO is changing the status quo, I think the evidence is there on the ground. And as we see Moscow rattling sabers outside of Ukraine, it's extremely worrisome. And they're using that as a way to try to change the agreement. We've seen the agreement was signed, it's codified that NATO could expand. So it's a rereading of history, it's a change of tone. And I think that the countries that have joined the EU and NATO, for example, the Baltics, are very glad that they have, because they're watching what Russia is doing, nibbling away at Ukraine, threatening it, what happened in Georgia, possibly what might happen in Moldova. I think that these are all worrying signs for these countries, and that's why they want to see NATO. Of course, I think damning by faint praise, when Putin said he supports, or Lavrov said that he really supports, like, the EU having this type of military, it kind of shows that they want to get rid of NATO, and they realize that the EU would be very weak and disorganized, and it would be very variable, depending on who's in office and who would be willing to invest. And it would take a very long time. I mean, although there's been a lot of money spent, there's really a lack of capacity. So I think that would be Putin's, you know, dream to have the EU do this. So I think that clever minds, even Macron has notched it down a bit in his speech last week. And I think they're more realistic. They do understand that it's not just burden sharing, it's burden shedding. The U.S. wants Europe to be more active. Thank you so much. Okay.
Thank you. On that, we will have to leave it. We are unfortunately out of time. Thank you to all three of you for taking part. Thorsten Benner, Teresa Fallon, and Glenn Deason. Thanks very much for being on Inside Story. And thank you, as always, for watching. Remember, you can see this program again anytime. Just go to our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, you can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle there is @AJInsideStory. From me, Hazem Seeker, and the whole team here, bye for now.